All right, welcome back, everyone. We're talking with Michael Hoffman about the Vatican. We're talking about the resignation of the Pope and, of course, his latest book, User in Christendom, The Mortal Sin That Was and Now Is Not. And I want to go back a little bit to the Pope. This, it's very interesting with this. I'm going to stay on the topic of your latest book about usury as well, Michael. But let's just for a moment go back to that again, because I wanted to ask you a little bit about the legacy, I guess, of the Pope. I read your latest post, if you will, your blog post about this abdication of Pope Benedict. You have some interesting critiques here of basically of the tradition, I guess we can call it, of what the latest Pope Benedict has kind of continued, if you will. If we get a new pope in there, in your honest view and opinion, is this anything that really is going to change? Does it really matter who's at the the seat of the papacy?
Well, I think it does, but not because it's the papacy. Because as a Christian, I hold out hope for every human being. If in my neighborhood there is someone who has a terrible reputation as being cruel or sadistic or drunken, if I'm impacted by that behavior, I'm going to pray for that person and hope for a miracle, which it is in God's power to change people and transform them. If I didn't believe in that, I couldn't believe in Christ and the gospel. And so I have the same hope for the Vatican. Christ says to, and the gospel says to, pray for your leaders. I remember in the days of George W. Bush, who I had to try very hard not to hate, my prayer was that God would inspire him and grant him wisdom or remove him, one or the other. And that would be basically my prayer for many of these corrupt leaders, including the Pope. But we would hold out hope that this next Pope, by miracle, would turn out to be someone very different from John Paul II and Paul VI, all of whom more or less held reign over this horrible molestation of children. Jesus said that a person who harms these little ones, it would be better that he had not even been born. And yet we have the heads of the post-Renaissance Catholic Church implicated in this, basically for two reasons, and probably these reasons are known to your listeners. One is the secrecy, which is attendant upon this enormous bureaucracy, as it is, to be fair, among many other bureaucracies, whether sure. It's the Central Intelligence Agency, the Kremlin, or whatever,
yep.
Or the British monarchy. But at the same time, also, even more troubling, is this idea that priests have a higher soul, a greater nobility, a more intense call on God than the regular laity do. And that's something that the Protestants began to detect and protest many hundreds of years ago. I don't think that it's necessarily ipso facto integral to the church, but they have to be vigilant against it, and there hasn't been that vigilance. I'll give you an example. Cardinal Castrileon Hoyos, he's from Latin America. He was one of the people that Benedict, as part of his move in 2007 to legalize the traditional Latin Mass more so than it had been largely derogated under Paul VI, he was trying to bring it back because, well, for reasons we could discuss later. But Hoyos was his point man in doing that. He was a fellow that had relations with the Society of St. Pius X, the group founded by Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre with the very controversial Bishop Richard Williamson, who gave the television broadcast in Germany where he said he did not believe that any Judaic people were gassed to death.
That was actually, just a small correction, that was actually with Swedish television he did that. I remember that. But he was under the threat of being extradited, I think, to Germany because, of what he said, basically.
Well, you're right. I stand corrected. The broadcast was shown in Sweden, but the interview was conducted in Germany, and therefore Germany claimed jurisdiction, although actually they claim universal jurisdiction against people who are skeptical or have doubts about certain sacred aspects of World War II history.
Yeah.
But anyway, Hoyos is a kind of heroic figure in the eyes of the traditionalists, and Hoyos is the one that we found out in the last couple of years wrote a letter to a bishop in France who had hidden a child molesting priest from the police, congratulating him for protecting the priesthood by hiding this priest.
Wow.
We have Cardinal Roger Mahoney, who recently retired as the Cardinal of Los Angeles, California, and similar corruption, similar protection of molesters and facilitation of molesters came out in his case. He will be voting to decide who the next pope is. Bernard Law in Boston was about to be arrested for facilitating molestations. Cardinal Bernard Law. You know, here in America, if you remember that Jimi Hendrix song, Hey Joe, and he shoots his girlfriend and he says, well, I'm going to go down to Mexico where the law can't find me. Well, you know, the Vatican is turning into a kind of Mexico, a haven for these these heinous fugitives, and that's where Law went. Now, you'd think if they had their wits about them and they weren't practicing a form of chutzpah, that they would hide this guy away in some monastery. Instead, they made him the archpriest of a basilica in Rome, a prominent basilica. They paid him $10,000 a month salary. And when John Paul II died, Bernard Law, who created so much havoc and mayhem for children in the Boston, Massachusetts area, presided over one of the funeral masses for John Paul II. So to me, Henrik, this almost harkens to a level of mockery that's so strong it almost seems occultic. In my investigation of occult crimes and murders, whether it's Jack the Ripper or other cases that I've looked at in my book, Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare, I've seen a type of occult nose-thumbing, a mockery, which often we see in the cases of megalomaniac or very prideful people. And I believe that this may be the phenomenon at work in Rome. Either that, or they're hopelessly incompetent, or they just think that they're immune from the level of disgust that so many people are exhibiting in the face of this nonsense. And Joseph Ratzinger has been complicit in this. There's no question about it. But I think the way that these guys wash their dirty laundry is they are master players, along with the British monarchy, in my opinion. There's a symbiotic relationship between the two, even though officially they've allegedly been deadly enemies.
Mm-hmm.
But they can play the right-wing card and the left-wing card. And essentially, at the bottom, I think, is the Kabbalistic notion of the chameleon, that no one really knows who you are, and you can placate and satiate one group against another. For example, when Paul VI put through his revolutionary new mass, the mass in the vernacular, the mass that no longer faces the East, and there was beginning to be a grassroots upheaval and protest for this, he issued his thoroughly orthodox encyclical, Humanae Vitae, which took a orthodox stand against contraception birth control. It's very much execrated by the liberal wing of the church, which had praised him for the new mass. And so I'm finding now, in the wake of my essay that you read about the abdication of Ratzinger, of Pope Benedict,
mm-hmm.
that I'm having some Middle Eastern Christians contacting me and saying, well, he's done a very good job in resisting the New World Order and the cryptocracy in Syria. He hasn't bought in to the line that the Salafists, Al-Qaeda type of revolutionaries who are fighting to overthrow Assad,
mm-hmm.
are actually liberation fighters. So there was a point in his favor. And I think that it's very Machiavellian and deliberate how they play one side against the other. Machiavelli himself basically wrote the textbook on this, and I think we're seeing it played out in the career of Joseph Ratzinger, which I consider to be a checkered career.
Well, very interesting points. My question has always been as well, on top of all this, Michael, is someone intentionally trying to discredit the name of the church, to almost at this point destroy the Roman Catholic Church? Are they mortal enemies with somebody? Is somebody trying to dethrone them from their power that they've held for so many thousands of years? Is that a viable possibility here?
Well, it's a good question, but I think it relates more to internal rivalry that you will see at a corporation. There'll be a huge corporation like here in the United States, General Electric. And inside the General Electric Corporation are executives who are involved in such intense rivalry, they're willing to blackmail each other. Sometimes we even hear, and I'm not talking specifically about GE in this case, but we even hear about murders and car wrecks that are staged to look like accidents and so forth. Now, people could say, well, does this mean that these guys are trying to destroy the General Electric Corporation or some other Fortune 500 corporation? No, I don't think so. I think it's part of human nature to try and achieve more power, to be resentful and envious of your competitors inside a corporate structure. And for me, inside the cryptocracy are these competing elites. One of them is the elite centered on the British monarchy and the Masonic Imperium that it represents. Another is centered inside the Renaissance Roman Church and the Neoplatonic Imperium that it represents. I think they both serve the same God. And I think that in different times and places, because the kind of research that I do is very much sensitive both to time and to place. If you remember your atomic theory, time relations are assumed to be first constituted by the specific physical relations obtaining between them. So that kind of matrix has to be considered here. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like talking about the Puritans as we did earlier. The early Puritans, the majority were opposed to usury. After, and so we're talking about, say, from 1520 on to about 1700. After 1700, more and more of them began to fulfill the caricature that the New Agers and the Catholics have of them. But that's a big error because they're overlooking the first couple hundred years of the Puritan institution. And by the same token, that's how we have to analyze what's going on with the church now. Where are we in time and place? Where are we in history? Where are we at this time? And how does this move by the Pope fit inside of there? And so the Catholic Church has always defended itself from critics like me who suggest there is a hidden occultic element in a symbiotic relationship with, for example, the Masonic Imperium by saying, look at how inside Masonry there is actually one of the degrees in Masonry involves stabbing the papal tiara and stomping on it and pledging the destruction of the Catholic Church as this hated institution. And all I would say is that's a theatrical drama intended for a lower level initiate. It's not intended for the people at the very top. There are grades of knowledge that is revealed to people inside these secret societies and other institutions of that kind.
Sure.
So while I would imagine that Saudi Arabia, the type of Islam that comes out of Saudi Arabia, has probably been, would like to see the fall and decline of the Catholic Church. On the other hand, I would have to say that even though Judaism is said to be a strong opponent of Catholicism, would they want to see the church destroyed and that 800 million people who are being channeled and shepherded under one shepherd, would they want to see that kind of power and influence eviscerated, or would they prefer to have their agent, a kind of crypto rabbi disguised as a pope who is on the throne and able to gradually evolve and alchemically transform these people into a type of philo-Judaic, pro-Zionist, post-Renaissance Catholic? And in
right.
that sense, the Catholic Church is very, very useful to the cryptocracy. So I doubt that the cryptocracy wants it to be destroyed because, in my judgment, it's one wing of the cryptocracy.
Well, that's a really good point, Michael. I think it's an interesting one, and I think it has some merit because this is what we've seen in the past. Instead of destroying something, obviously, you try to infiltrate it and use it to your advantage because the power structure and the whole infrastructure is already there in place. It would take too much to build that up anew, if you will. What do you make then of something like, you mentioned Richardson before, or Williamson rather, sorry, and also there was another guy now, not too while ago, I think it was Bishop Bernard Fellay. They come from the Society of Saint Pius X, and they've been going out and saying things like that they see the Jews as the enemies of the church and stuff like that, and also considering what what Williamson talked about was highly controversial. Is this just a branch of the church which is pretty much uncontrolled, or because they do have ties to the Vatican, I believe, and that they're still kind of part of the greater organization, correct?
Well, that's a very good question. Actually, Fillet is and Williamson isn't, and my assessment of Bishop Fillet would be someone who had attempted to win the favor of Pope Benedict XVI and would have been willing to co-opt the Society of St. Pius X in the way that Benedict wanted him to do, but who could not sell it to his membership. In other words, He was pursuing a usurpation of the society, but it had to be subtle. And the Vatican, its liberal wing, coming out of some of the Austrian and German bishops who were opposed to any kind of rapprochement, Benedict XVI, in the tug of war that was going on internally, ended up turning some of the negotiations over to them, and they asked for some concessions from Fillet, which I think that personally Fillet would have wanted to grant, but he would have been worried because his right wing was accusing him of being a sellout, and he was worried about a huge division inside the society, which has about 500 priests and hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in real estate around the world, much of it contributed by the last remnants of whatever you want to call the French aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
Williamson is a very different person indeed. Bishop Fillet comes out of French Switzerland. Williamson comes out of an Anglican background in England. I know him personally. He's an exceedingly courageous and honest man. Very eccentric. I disagree with quite a bit of what he says about women and his ideas about education and women. There's plenty to disagree with there, but his integrity is really something to behold, and especially where he has stood up and taken on the some of the claims about what went on in the concentration camps. He hasn't been so unsophisticated as to use the term the Jews. I think that the Talmudists who keep Judaic people in bondage, the way the post-Renaissance Romanists keep Catholics in bondage, I think they actually like it when people speak in those sloppy generalizations, because so many Judaic people are alienated from the Talmud, alienated from the rabbis. Why should we alienate them by speaking in general general pejorative terms? And maybe Williamson did that early on in his career, but I don't see him doing that now. In fact, his statement about gas chambers in Auschwitz-Birkenau was very nuanced. He never said that the Holocaust didn't happen or the brutal and terrible things did not happen to Judaics. He addressed himself scientifically to one issue about which he has doubts. And in my opinion, whether you feel he's right or wrong, every human being should have the right to entertain doubt.
Well, exactly. This was, sorry to cut you off there, but I mean, I saw the interview again because it was on SVT, the Swedish channel that made it. And I just like... certainly anybody can disagree with his proposition or his doubt, but nonetheless, why is he not allowed to ask the question, or the questions that he did? He just basically throws it out and questions, was it done this way? Was it the number that we are given? And he referenced some stuff there, but it's a crime to just raise the question at this stage, which is horrible.
And it's become a new theology in the Catholic Church. It emerged under John Paul II. He began to use the Judaic religious word for Holocaust, Shoah, S-H-O-A-H. And it entered Catholic theology, and Williamson, after his excommunication was lifted by Benedict XVI as part of these negotiations with the SSPX and Fillet, Williamson was told that he could not resume his episcopal functions as long as he held those doubts. Now, what do aspects of secular history, suppose I doubt that Abraham Lincoln was a good politician or a good man, suppose I regard him as a warmonger who forced a needless war on the South and that slavery would have ended anyway in another 10 or 15 years, should I be denied my right to serve as a Catholic bishop? It seems ludicrous from the point of view of the history of the Catholic Church. But that's the degree to which, since Vatican II, the hierarchy has pandered to these very powerful forces. Well, Williamson refuses to pander, and he was recently expelled from the Society of St. Pius X, and there's now a little split there, and there has been a splinter group which has spun off. And you mentioned Fillet recently making some statements about the Jews that were negative.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was cosmetic, intended to bolster his image as he's assailed as being a sellout. He's been sort of taking Vatican tactics and turning to his right wing and throwing them a bone and hoping they'll gnaw on it, and whether people see through that or not. I'm told that a few days later he actually withdrew his remarks. But I see him as a politician, and Williamson is much more in the mold of some of the old churchmen like Stephen Langton who was not to overpraise Bishop Williamson, although I don't think you can overpraise his courage, but Langton was the bishop who was instrumental in helping to bring about the Magna Carta against King John in England. I think Williamson is more in that mold. For example, he's on trial for the fourth time in the district court in Regensburg, and he's basically unemployed now and doesn't have a lot of funds, but one of his supporters was willing to pay the 1,600 euro fine that was levied against him, and that would end the case. And Williamson refused to allow the fine to be paid. He said that this Mark of Cain, which has been branded on the soul of Germans with the notion that they are genetically a homicidal people, that he's going to do his part to try to lift what is in fact a kind of psychological or mental genocide. And that's a very noble thing to do. And so I'm an admirer of him to that extent. But that would be my analysis of the little attempt that Pope Benedict made in order to bring back into the fold the most loyal Catholics, the ones who say their rosary, who value the mass, who have large families, don't practice birth control. That would impress any institution where you have a loyal cadre that you would like to bring back into the church who will pay and obey without questioning, which is of course, what a criticism of Catholics in the United States. But there's one more thing before, if you don't mind, Henrik, before
sure,
we
ahead.
Leave this. And that is that something that's developing out of the Society of St. Pius X among some of their more astute prelates, there's four bishops altogether that were illicitly consecrated bishops in Switzerland by Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre, the late bishop from France. And one of them is Bishop Bernard Tissier de Malleray. And he has made certain, I want to be very careful about what I say here because maybe sometime you'll have him on the program and he can make more precise statements than I would. But he has hinted about having a new understanding of obedience inside the Catholic Church. And I think that's excellent, if I've understood him correctly, and I hope he pursues that, although it will take courage to do so. Because I think that the stroke of genius of the cryptocracy is to use the powers that the papacy exerts over Catholic people in terms of the obedience that it demands of them and they've been willing to give to put forward many of these destructive changes which we've been talking about. And I think that the notion of papal infallibility, even when it's limited to how it's actually defined rather than as the world sees it, the Pope is infallible when he chooses a pair of shoes or when he makes a statement about the death penalty or something like that. It has never been defined that way. It's been defined as when the Pope speaks in matters of faith and morals, he's infallible. In other words, a formal statement. Well, of course, going back to Leo X in 1515, that was a formal statement in favor of usury. So he wasn't infallible then. And I have to say that I don't see Jesus Christ investing in any of the apostles in infallibility. At one point, the supposed first pope, and I believe that we could say that he was, Peter, the apostle, was upbraided by Paul for Judaizing and being sort of discriminatory against Gentile Christians. So for me, it's fairly obvious that this rather Rococo, Byzantine, ultramontane understanding of Catholicism in terms of the pope being this all-seeing, omniscient figure is actually destructive of the doctrines that are most sacred to Roman Catholics. And so the fact that an ultra-traditionalist like Bishop Tissier de Malleray would be moving in this direction is going to create problems for the cryptocracy in that it wants to be able to use papal power for its own good, and yet here is a traditionalist theoretician saying we need to look at it and re-examine it again. And that would be, in my judgment, a positive move.
There's so many, questions and points I still have here, and we managed to get to some of them as well as we kind of carry on here, Michael. But tell us more about usury as a weapon, as you said before, and how you see the economic system of, I guess we could say the West have been destroyed pretty much. Banking frauds, bailouts, CEO banking bonuses skyrocketing. We have crimes at this point of Goldman Sachs and Chase and all these big banks. What is it? What's the root of all this, do you think?
Well, I would say that I would preface my remarks by saying I've been enormously influenced by Dante and by Dante's chief disciple in the 20th century, Ezra Pound. And both of them really brought us around to the spiritual dimensions of the destructive quality of usury. One of the things Pound brings out is there any more unnatural engine of accumulation than compound interest? Because you and I will die. The forests will become decayed in certain cases. Pretty much everything in the natural world has a life cycle, birth, maturity, and death. But money put out in interest multiplies itself forever. And so for the seers and prophets of the secular Western civilization, like Dante and Pound, this was seen as a kind of original sin out of which someone like me begins to see that cloning and genetic modification of foods actually are derived from. Because when you have this artifice that money can breed money, which the ancient world, the pre-Christian ancient world, always recognized, even though they didn't put their recognition into practice, unfortunately, because they too were imbued with a kind of situation ethics. In other words, the statement, you have to be practical. But philosophically, they always recognized that interest on money. Money is sterile. That was the argument of Thomas Aquinas. Money is sterile, and if you allow it to breed money, it's the most fundamentally artificial process that you have in civilization. And they couldn't foresee the tremendously artificial civilization, or civilization, as I like to call it, that we are inhabiting today, where we're beginning to reach the outer bounds of the robotization and the Frankenstein foods and things that you and your audience are well familiar and I don't need to catalog. So it begins there. It also begins with a step away from what Christ taught. Christ taught that riches were actually an impediment to being a Christian. He said it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to get to heaven. Does anybody today really believe that? Most of us are trying to get rich. Now, since with God all things are possible, it is possible if a rich man helps his neighbor and uses his money and resources in a way that God blesses, that that man can get to heaven. But the fundamental orientation of the Catholic Church or the Christian Church from its inception has been against the material process, against accumulation, for the life of the Spirit. And when you don't have a lot of money, what do you end up doing? You end up turning to your neighbors. You have to build a community. You must rely on them, or you have nothing. Well, a lot of us now live in our little castle-like homes. Mother Teresa said that when she was asked about the poverty of India, she said, well, compared to the poverty of Europe and America, India is rich. And people were astounded. They said, what are you talking about? And she said, the poverty of loneliness. People reside alone with your television set. You can build these walls by virtue of your money. So greed and avarice led to usury, led to money breeding money, which then led to the rise of interest on money, compound interest. You put your money in the bank when you're 12 years old. Your grandfather is wealthy, and he says, Henrik, I want you to have 100,000 kroner, or whatever the Swedish currency is. Forgive me for not.
No, you're right.
Is it kroner? Okay.
Yep, yep.
And then you put it in the bank, and you forget about it until you're 40. And suddenly, you have a huge sum of money for which you have done nothing.
Yeah.
There's no labor. There is no nothing. So, in the eyes of the philosophers of Western civilization, the Church, this was a type of parasitism, which bred every other parasitism. So in my book, Usury in Christendom, I talk about how many left-wing Catholics, good Catholics like Dorothy Day, Peter Morin, and others like them, have been part of this movement of what they call social justice. And it's very noble. They try to ameliorate the condition of the poor and make society more just. But my protest against this is that it's basically palliative. It's putting a Band-Aid on a cancer.
Sure.
And the cancer is interest on money. And until we focus our campaign on the issue of interest on money, And surprisingly, for a lot of the New Agers who think that the Old Testament is a demonic book from a demonic god, what attracted me to the Old Testament was the justice code was there. Because originally, I didn't have quite so Jaundiced a view, but I certainly had a Jaundiced view when I was much younger, 20, 25 years ago, concerning the Old Testament. And then as I researched the movement for Jubilee in the 19th century in Great Britain, and I saw that they were talking about Leviticus 25 in the Jubilee, and I saw the justice code that was in the Old Testament, no oppression of widows and orphans, talking about how God would punish judges who took bribes, and perhaps most especially, besides the condemnation of usury towards fellow Israelites, was also the statement that no loan could, even a non-usurious loan, because the Bible sees anyone who owes money as being in bondage, and God doesn't want us in bondage. So if we have to be in bondage, we might need to grow our business, or we're in an emergency, medical care, or whatever, we take out a loan. Hopefully it isn't interest-bearing. But God says to the lender, to the creditor, you have 7 years to collect that loan, because at the end of 7 years, all debts are cleared. That's fantastic. If we had that operating in the West today, so many people would be free. Now, obviously, there'd have to be different kinds of arrangements, different types of loans, but it could be worked out. And so, for me, the Christians who are the heirs of the Old Testament, as it was renewed and cleansed by Christ, cleansed of its ceremonial aspects by Jesus Christ, we should be the ambassadors of that in society. And you asked me about what is the engine of the money power. Well, it is this greeting money for money. It is this compound interest. It's what Richard Seymour, the left-wing historian of Marxism and economics in Great Britain, called the financialization of the world. Why are we surprised when the world, at least in the West, but it appears to be the same in China as well, if not more so, that the world is not in the hands of the producers and the farmers and the inventors in large part. It's in the hands of those who are best at manipulating digital entries in a computer the form of what we call money. And I would say that if we're engaged in the task of overthrowing that and abolishing that, it would be, as wise generals, we ought to take our troops and we ought to point them at the headquarters of the problem rather than the branches of the problem. The headquarters is usury itself. And so that has been my focus as my contribution to this campaign for justice.
Very good, Michael. So if we for a moment talk about where the tenets of this principle come from, if we can try to get to the root of this, because this is occult economics, I would call it, and you've kind of clarified this, of making something out of nothing pretty much. Is this something we can track back to Babylonian era? Is this something found within the Talmud? Explain this a little bit to us.
I think it's part of human nature. Again, this runs contrary to the New Age, which believes that we're born so beautiful and so perfect, and then it's just our parents and our churches that turn us into the stinkers that we turn out to be. as a believer, I believe that there is something about being born into the material world that creates some type of a mark. It's a mark on our character, and this is beyond the ken of the rational. So it's something I do what Carl Jasper says, and I make that transcendent leap of faith. And you're certainly welcome to criticize me for it. But it's also an instinctual thing, because I've been around. I'm the father of a large family, so I've been at a lot of births, and I see how beautiful babies are. It's probably the greatest thing that's happened to me in my life. I can't imagine how wonderful it would be to be a midwife and be present at 900 or 1,000 births. But to see these children emerge from the hand of God, they're beautiful, they're holy, they're happy. But nonetheless, as they progress, it's not for me a progression through evil parents and wicked churches. It's a progression through the materiality of the created universe. That something happens that we pick up as part of whatever it is that here. Theologically, I would call it the results of the fall, which Christ came to overcome. But perhaps scientifically or philosophically, someone in the future will come up with another explanation. Whatever you want to call for it, this is a combination of both my belief and also my observation. And so that I feel that the human penchant to be greedy is something that's part of human nature. It's just like they say the oldest profession is prostitution, because not only the urge to reproduce, but also an appreciation of the human body that goes beyond an appreciation of it, goes to a demand to have that body when we want that body, leads to prostitution. And these are, in my opinion, fundamental orientations of a flawed human nature. And again, I know that's a big heresy for the New Age, but I guess I'm a heretic. Out of that, I think we could, it would be as difficult to trace the genesis of usury, or the idea of charging something above what we're lending for the use of what we're lending, in terms of this mutum, in other words, of this money. It would be like trying to find out who was the first prostitute. I don't think that it can be done, because I think it's a component of human nature. But what intrigues me is that under ancient Israel, God forbade this initial impulse of man to get something for nothing. And yes, he did give permission as a weapon of warfare, and this is very controversial. Critics of my book keep hitting me with this. Well, God endorsed usury, they say. Well, you know, you can also say, and many critics of the Bible do say this, that God endorsed murder. But I think that is a gross exaggeration of what actually happened, because the people who were being wiped out before the coming of the Messiah were people who were engaged in magica sexualis of what was regarded as false gods. You can't find people in the Bible who are being destroyed unless they fit that criterion. I'm neither justifying it or not justifying it. It exists and it's there. But it isn't like, according to a biblical theology, that God just decided, oh, here's some people who aren't Jews, let's kill them, I've got nothing better to do today. And usury, so to me, the brilliance of what God is saying about usury, as he allows the Israelites to employ it as a weapon of warfare, is that he is warning us that it is indeed a weapon of warfare. It is a type of a sword, and so we should learn something from that, but I'm afraid that we haven't. And so ancient Israel was otherwise absolutely proscribed from using interest on money against each other. Then when the Messiah of Israel, the Lord of love, was incarnated, Jesus Christ of Nazareth, he came along and he adjusted God's law, as I quoted you from the book of Luke, where he said, lend expecting nothing in return, including to your enemies. That's the kind of defenselessness and vulnerability that Christianity, that's how it won so many followers, and that is what it's supposed to represent. And that's why it's such an abomination when my country, the United States of America, against my will, proceeds with these crusades against Muslims and other people in the name of spreading Christianity by the sword. And it's an old story and an old transgression, but that the fact that it's old doesn't make it any less onerous for our time. So for me, it's brilliant that the Old Testament proscribed it, except in the case that I mentioned, and then the New Testament completely outlawed it. And if you examine the history of it, which you can see from my book, it actually managed to suppress this tremendous urge of greed all the way through the apostolic age, the early Middle Ages, the Middle Ages, even the late Middle Ages. And it wasn't until the dawn of the Renaissance that you finally saw human nature reasserting it again. So for me, I can see the hand of God in history through believing Christians. That's probably the longest period in recorded history where humanity was able to really keep usury out of the fore. And you look at a king, and I'll finish up on this, you look at a king like St. Edward the Confessor, the last Saxon king of England, and you look at his reign, and I encourage you and your listeners to do so. This was a reign where he was adamantly opposed to usury, And many English historians consider it one of the happiest, most benevolent, and peaceful times in Great Britain. Now, I realize there's libertarian capitalists will say, oh, yeah, and they were plowing with oxen, and it was very retrograde and atavistic. But how did my reply to that is, how then were these magnificent edifices, the Gothic cathedrals and some of the beautiful Gothic wooden churches that you have in Sweden and elsewhere, but especially looking at the stone Gothic churches, in many cases, we don't even know how they built them today. Those churches were built in large part without interest on money. So great things can be achieved. In fact, I believe the economy is being held back by interest on money. I don't think it's the engine of a productive, just economy. It's the engine of a parasitic economy that's out of control based on warfare and avarice that we're seeing all around us today.
Well, there's a constant growth that is part of a system like that, that you constantly have to pump things into it. And it's kind of, in my opinion, it's destined to fail, as it has, as a bubble as well. But at the same time, I guess what you're advocating is back to some kind of a true value system, that something actually has a value. It's not something that goes up and down, and everything is fluctuating in our times. It's like there's no stability in anything anymore, Michael. And this causes both an illusion of progress, but also an illusion that things are moving in some way or even changing. But the fact is that, I mean, at the end of the day, a potato is a potato. And I mean, it takes, you know, effort or work to plant it and then take it out of the ground. But that necessarily shouldn't, it doesn't become more or less than that. This is different for different products, of course. But again, just back to that point, that there is a true value in something, in a system like this completely throws that off, in my opinion.
Well, the illusion of progress is very important. I'm glad you brought that up, because I see that as a product of the new God that we have in our 21st century of scientism. If the scientists make the statement about that the universe was created 12.5 billion years ago in the Big Bang, a lot of people who don't believe that the Blessed Mother was a virgin or that Christ resurrected from the dead will believe that. I tend to ask, how do you know that? Even my friend Noam Chomsky, in his area of academic expertise in linguistics, has made statements about, well, 10,000 years ago came the rise of this particular language. And as a skeptic about things that are not related to my own bailiwick, of my biblical faith, I turn skepticism on the skeptics and say, well, you know, I can't believe that. How do you know that? And it seems to me that skepticism among modern people is largely one way. They are willing to doubt authority when the authority is Christian or biblical, but when the authority comes up and says that Homo sapiens evolved from a worm or this mouse or this monkey, and I'm expected to believe it, and I'm denounced because I don't, then I feel that we have a religion. There is such a thing as science, but science is based on the rules of evidence, and I can respect that. But then there's scientism, which relates to an arbitrary means of measurement and is actually a form of religion disguised as hyper-rationality. And I think that's at the root of what you're talking about in terms of an illusion of progress. I see us as devolving. I could certainly believe that man is on his way to becoming a monkey, whereas I think we started out as angels.
Wow. Yeah, well, that's a good point. And most days I do agree with you, unfortunately, seeing how things are turning out. But there's so many points here, obviously, that unfortunately we won't be able to have time to get to today. But I wanted to ask you something here as well, because it just ties a little bit into your book, Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare. And that's, if you could define, if there is such a thing as a religion of the cryptocracy that you've been talking about, and again, that you talk about in the book that I just referenced, would it be Kabbalistic in origin? Would it be Talmudic Judaism? Or is that a simplification? Could you put, if there is a religious term on what they use, if you will, the cryptocracy, what would that be, Michael?
I would say the original religion of the cryptocracy would be self-worship and everything that emanates from that. And that would be analogous with Satan, who was a self-worshipper and who also said to legitimate authority, as opposed to our right to rebel against illegitimate authority, but to creation and to the creator who was behind creation, this Satan figure said, non serviam, I will not serve creation. I will not serve the Creator. I will be outside of creation. In other words, I will be artificial. I will run against nature and against the grain. And the person who is worshiping themselves when they are not their own creator is replicating that. And I feel sorry for people, whether we want to call them Talmudists or Kabbalists or some other type of occultists, who believe that by allying with this satanic force, and of course not all occultists by any means believe that they're doing that, but for the ones who are, this satanic figure, and I would just, if you ask for a definition of Satan, I would say that force which encapsulates a total absence of love. That's what how I would define Satan. Well, that force is the enemy of humanity, and yet it is put forth through the cryptocracy as being the great liberating figure. So long before there was a Pharisaic Judaism, which after all is just the deterioration of Israel, and there probably is no more anti-Judaic book or anti-Jewish book than the Old Testament, even though many people think it is an egoistical support for the Jewish national project, that's largely rabbinic propaganda. The Old Testament itself is very, very anti-Jewish insofar as those covenanted people had betrayed God. And so, for example, when the prophet Isaiah talked about Israel needed its lips being purified for all the blasphemies that had spoken against God, in the Talmud, the prophet Isaiah is justifiably killed. And you remember Christ's reference when he accused the Pharisees of having the blood of all the prophets on their hands. In other words, being the spiritual and ideological heirs. He wasn't talking in racial terms, and we shouldn't talk in those terms today, but spiritually and ideologically. Well, here's a proof text in the Talmud I can point you to where they say that Isaiah got what he deserved. In fact, the Talmud says, because he spoke blasphemy against the people of Israel, you see the self-worship again, he died by having a saw sawed across his mouth. But that's, as Israel degenerated in Old Testament times and one faction created the Pharisees and then the rival sect, the Sadducees, and the self-worship that they embodied. But this was a fairly recent phenomenon compared with the civilizations of Sumer and Pharaonic Egypt. And I would trace much of what's wrong in the Kabbalah and the Talmud, or even in Babylon, which was relatively a more recent comer, to what was happening in Pharaonic Egypt, which is a study that very much fascinates me. The entire occult state religion centered around Tanis Maior, the dog star Sirius, and all that that entails. But then you're asking me to even precede that. We would have to go to Sumer, and then it's lost in the midst of time. But basically, I would say that where human pride and self-worship comes to the fore, then all kinds of ceremonies are created in order to enthrall humanity within that imperium and not to let us get free of it. And from that, man himself has created all of these various secret societies. The Muslims have them, the Buddhists, the Tantric, it's not just the Judaics, and of course the Gentile form of it. And we're cursed with it until we can wake up about these topics.
Okay, we're going to wrap up here in a minute or so. We've, of course, primarily been talking about Michael Hoffman's latest book, User in Christendom, The Mortal Sin That Was and Now Is Not. But there's much more, of course. You have much more available on your website, Michael. But please give us your URL again. And, of course, if you want to, you know, mention some of your other book titles, you have audio CDs, DVDs, newsletters, please go ahead.
Yes, we do have an online store, and we can process orders internationally online if people are interested in doing that. It's pretty obvious if they go to the website how to get the books online. Some of the books are available through Amazon.com. Most of the DVDs, CDs, and my newsletter is not. You have to go to our own store for that. And our website, once again, is www.revisionisthistory.org.
All right. Well, thank you for your time today, Michael. We appreciate it. Thank you for sharing your perspective with us.
Thank you, Henrik, for the opportunity.
All right, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you found the discussion stimulating and that you managed to learn something new. Don't miss our next program with the True Art. We are going to talk about the conversion of Caesareans to Judaism, Jesus, Christianity, and the bigger picture of how the elite and the occult bankers have subverted society, using everything from revolutionary movements, international socialism, Marxism, the Frankfurt School, and the Hegelian dialectic. And later we have Lynn Picknett, Richard Hoagland, and we're going to talk with Tom Horn, as well, of course, about the Pope, Petrus Romanus, and what is going on currently at the Vatican. And for now, thank you for listening. We appreciate your interest, and we are so grateful for your support as we continue to lay out as much as we can on the table, discuss the subjects we find interesting so that we and you can formulate our own picture and learn and hopefully grow in that process of discovery as well. Thank you, guys and gals. We will talk more soon. Take good care.